I'm General Manager Perry Metz, and welcome to WFIU's Profiles. This program is a weekly that introduces members of our community, as well as notable visiting artists, scholars, and entertainers, to the WFIU audience. Our guest today is Richard McCaig. Dick is Vice Provost for Student Affairs and Dean of Students, and has been in the student affairs field for 38 years here. Dick, as you look across four decades of working with students, how have they stayed the same? How is the student of 1971 the same as the student of 2009?
Well, the base characteristics, the young kid heading off to college, excited about the future, anxious as to what college might bring, convinced that they have a positive life ahead and a contribution to make. Those are continuing characteristics, the sense of freedom that comes with the college experience, the testing, the making good and bad decisions simultaneously, it seems, and learning from those experiences. Those are pretty consistent themes of higher education, and at least my work with students over the last 40 years.
But one of the big challenges of being a student affairs professional, more than even being a faculty member in English or a staff member in radio TV services, is a student affairs person has to deal with every changing direction of student interest, every new generation of students, and it seems to me the generations of students are shorter and shorter. How do you cope with their different ideas and attitudes?
I think it starts with a respect for the individual student, taking them as they are rather than what you wish they would be, suspending judgment a little bit, not spending so much time reflecting on, well, when I was in college or at this other place, we did it this way, sort of suspending that judgment. And then you do try to immerse yourself as best you can in student culture. So when MTV comes along, you watch some MTV. Mm-hmm. And when the iPods are present, you get your own iPod and load it with your music. You try and immerse yourself a little bit in the world they're experiencing. Not that you necessarily are trying to emulate what they're doing, but to at least understand their perspective.
I know that you have followed that immersion theory, and we'll get to that in a second. But you talked about not being judgmental. At the same time, the dean of students is supposed to be a judge when there are problems.
Yeah, it requires a little bit of a dual personality. There's an institutional role of accountability that is prescribed for the dean of students. When doing that, I clearly remind myself I'm an educator and this is an educational process, and we are holding to the student to standards that students and faculty and staff have agreed upon are the standards of our academic community. So it is sort of a different mindset at that point in time, and that hat comes off and on as need be.
Now, when you started in 71 at IU, you were in the student activities office. It was a time when students brought record players to campus. They didn't have computers. They didn't have CDs. They didn't have DVDs. They didn't have VCRs. The electronics were far fewer. And then you make reference to MTV coming along. You actually have been dean as MTV appeared and changed the music world, and almost as MTV disappeared and stopped playing music videos altogether. Mm-hmm. What have you felt in changing with these technologies, trying out a 24-hour music channel, an iPod, Facebook?
Oh, I suppose the exhilaration of sort of feeling like you're on the cutting edge in some respects of where things are going. Clearly, there was a point in time, and I can't remember how many years ago, that our freshmen were significantly more tech savvy than our seniors. And that was sort of a strange moment because that's a very short time frame. But I can remember talking with the family, and the incoming freshman daughter was talking about some things with computing, and the senior member of the family, the daughter who was a senior here, was saying, well, I just don't really understand any of that. But and so it, you clearly did see that happen. And students became my educators. Music downloading is a questionable activity when not legally prescribed. But I can remember before we had decided how evil this was, I was being instructed by students in the residence halls how you do it. Shortly thereafter, we adopted policies that shouldn't happen. But when it was all new and fresh and exciting and just on the scene, students in the residence halls were teaching me how to do it when I spent one of my nights in the residence halls.
You're referring to the advent of companies like Napster, which provided the venue or the portal
exactly.
by which students could download music for free and share it, and for a long time did until the recording industry objected.
Right, and I was being taught what Napster was in a hands-on demonstration in the residence hall, and a few weeks later in an administrative meeting was hearing about this new product called Napster, which was going to be a problem.
And indeed it was, and some IU students were sued.
Yes, exactly.
You also refer to having spent some nights in the residence hall. How many years ago did you start doing that?
I think maybe it may have been as many as 10 or 15 years ago. It was a time where I had moved from the transition from the student activities office and heavy involvement with students to the administrative role of dean of students that had all the potential to be more administrative and less contact with students. And so I began to look for ways to be sure that I had interaction with a broad range of students, and spending the night in a residence hall seemed like a good way to do that.
And you've done it every year since.
Didn't accomplish it this past year, but almost every year since.
Well, this was the victory lap year, and I think people understood you had a lot of events to go to congratulate you. And as your wife tells me, that she's now expected in your retirement to provide a plaque once a week, or else you'll feel very lonely.
The campus has been very kind to me this year, that's for sure.
Now, you started in your student affairs work at Wisconsin State University, Stevens Point. You were director of student activities, then came here as student government advisor and assistant director of student activities later. That gives you a perspective, having studied at Ball State, at Stevens Point, you worked at IU Bloomington, three public institutions in the Midwest drawing from largely at that time the circle of Midwestern states. Did it give you a general impression of what to expect from your career, or were you surprised?
Well, I think it probably did certainly give me a good grounding in what I might expect. I never anticipated being a dean of students. I really enjoyed working with students in the out-of-class environment and really using that environment to help them apply what they were learning in the classroom and really develop their own life skills. It certainly gave me a profound respect for the role of higher education in improving society and helping individuals follow their dreams. As you say, it tends to be a relatively narrow slice of the country in one sense because it's primarily the Midwest. But the Midwest is known for its strong work ethic, and the students that come to those institutions tend to be kids who represent those values. They represent a variety of abilities. The university in Wisconsin was more of a regional kind of campus at the time. Indiana University obviously has a worldwide student body. Stevens Point was a wonderful place to begin. It was a town with one stoplight, as I recall, when I got there, and a relatively small campus of 6,000 maybe, but a wonderful place to begin a career with a gentleman who was serving as vice president and dean of students, Bill Steelstra, who had, I think, graduated from Purdue, but was an excellent role model and was just a wonderful place to get grounded in what was going to be the field I was going to spend my life in.
When you came here, you took on for a number of years the formal and informal role of advising student government. Arriving in 1971, you were close on the heels of the period of student unrest, great gatherings, riots, assemblies, even a takeover of Bryan Hall. And you were segueing into a decade of activism, but on a much lower level and more local, followed then by the Me Decade. And throughout, student government has struggled always to find its place, whether it was to be a political body advocating for students, a programming entity, a service provider for students, or just a watchdog on faculty and administration. What was your advice to them about how to be most effective?
Well, we have to acknowledge first, I'm told students I'm a student government groupie because I was involved in student government as an undergraduate. And so that gave me a feeling that this was the kind of organization that could be important for an institution. Generally, with student government, I've shared advice that frankly, some student leaders have shared with me. Jeff Richardson, who was a student body president here in the early 70s, used to talk about the student body president's role as sort of a soapbox, and it gives you an opportunity to raise issues and ask questions, and it's not a position in which you necessarily can change anything by yourself, but if you ask the right questions or raise the right issues, other kinds of things can be set in motion. So I've tended to remind student government of their ability to create change by raising ideas, by asking questions. I've tended to suggest to them the importance of setting priorities because, in fact, it's a very short year that they're in office. And I've tried to suggest to them the importance of building coalitions among students because student government in and of itself, it's frankly just one organization, but on a campus like ours with several hundred organizations and at least 20 to 30 major student organizations, if you could build coalitions across student organizations, particularly across student subcultures of organizations, and then raise common questions with the institution, there's a great deal of power that students actually do hold. We have a tendency to kind of say, oh, that's something that those traditional fraternity and sorority people are interested in, or that's something that those academic students are interested in, or that's something those activist students are interested in. If they all raise the same question, several of us set up and take notice. And so I've suggested to them coalition building is also an important part of their work in student government.
Which means then developing their relationships with the presidents of other student organizations and amassing a coalition of the willing, as
exactly.
it were.
Exactly.
That ties to comments. Because this is the year in which you retire, there have been a lot of articles written either about an activity that you've come to for the last time or something you've been known for. And students who've been interviewed have said, as I think typified by one, who said, Dean McKeag has offered a lot of guidance, but he never tells us what to do. And that's been his success. Is that a fair statement?
Well, it's certainly a statement one can love to hear. And honesty, I certainly have never sought to tell students what to do. In my own indirect ways, I hope I have suggested there are better things to do and less better things to do. At the same time, I've always recognized that, in fact, students as individuals can make their own decisions and tried to suggest that the important thing for them to remember is there are consequences. So in that context, sure, what I've done is offered the ability for them to make their own decisions and not tried to make them for them.
Not to put too philosophical a point on it, that reminds me of Herman Wells describing the wonder and beauty of the arrival of new students on campus, because with them they always bring questions, sometimes uncomfortable ones, sometimes ones we don't want to hear, but ones that are appropriate in a college community and helpful in their development as individuals and citizens.
Well, it's a very good point. And it also caused me to reflect that in my years in working with students, I've always been amazed. There will be students who come up with ideas that I am convinced in my own mind have no chance of ever going anywhere because who could possibly be interested? Mm. And the event is enormously successful. And then others that I personally think, you know, this is exactly what the campus needs, and it falls flat on its face. And it also much depends on the enthusiasm and the commitment and the feeling of ownership that the student has with the idea. And so that's another reason why I'm somewhat humbled and reminded that it isn't the world according to McKeag, and I'm a little bit better to facilitate than I am to try and direct. In fact, when I talk to a student government and try and help them realize the impact they have on the institution, having had the advantage of 38 years at Indiana University, I will occasionally draw out changes at the university that are currently in place. We take them for granted. We see them as good ideas. And I will remind them that they started in a student government discussion and were even advocated by a student government president maybe and told, no, that's not going to happen. We're not interested in that. And 4 years later, it's implemented.
There it is.
And, of course, by then, that student has graduated and moved on to New York and is in a job. And no one goes back and says, you know, it was really nice that that student raised that 4 years ago.
And they themselves may not know.
And they themselves may not know.
Now, Dick, you know that in Profiles, we always pause to play a musical selection that our guest has brought in. And I gather that one of the ones you brought for us today is by two IU faculty members.
Sylvia McNair and Andre Previn, actually. I'm sort of a fan of what I guess they call the Great American Songbook, and this is a CD I discovered not that long ago, and a couple nice songs from it that were of interest, and I thought it'd be good to reflect, because one of the things that I so much enjoy about Indiana University is the arts that are available in this community, and then to actually know two members of our faculty who have been nationally, internationally successful, it just puts another special spin on this place.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather just can't get my poor self together.
Dick, while you've been working in student affairs, you have chosen to specialize, in addition to your general work with hundreds of student organizations, you've become something of an expert on the college fraternity and, in fact, have been the director, executive director of the Center for the Study of the College Fraternity from 1983 to 2005. What role do you see going forward for fraternities and sororities in American university life?
Well, in one sense, they've always been a bit controversial. From the very beginning, they were alternatives to what the institution was offering for students. And in more recent years, we've certainly been concerned about the behavior issues that have been associated with the organizations. But at their core, the fundamental values the organizations hold are very consistent with the values of the institution. And at their core, the whole idea of friendship or brotherhood or sisterhood, the creating linkages between the university and the student, the promotion of philanthropy, all of that has great value for us as a society and great value for us as an institution. Indiana University's first fraternity was founded in 1845. Mm. And so we're talking an extended time period at this institution of involvement with Greeks. And so my expectation is for an institution like us, these organizations are ways for us to involve alumni, to remind alumni of their good times in college, a way for alumni to be involved in the institution. Certainly it doesn't cut across the entire spectrum of the population. It's only about 20% of our students that have been involved in the organizations, but they have benefits for the students involved. They have benefits for the institution. I hope they will remain viable, and I hope we can begin to address more directly some of the ways in which those organizations haven't quite lived up to their ideals.
And certainly that's how they make the papers, make the news, is when something happens, some act of hazing occurs, or someone is injured. And yet when I talk to alumni, I often hear descriptions of sorority or fraternity life in glowing terms, with friendships made that are still going 50 years later, with tales of service and citizenship activities that formed a pattern in their lives and that it bonded them to the institution in a way they had not felt before they joined. And of course, they always remind me that studies show that Greek members have higher GPAs than other students when taken as a group. How can there be this dichotomy side by side like that?
Well, of course, what we have to remember is the rosy-colored glasses we all look through when we reflect back on our wonderful college days. And we have to acknowledge that members of fraternities and sororities are students of Indiana University. And so most of the problems that are associated with fraternities and sororities are problems associated with student life in the year 2009. And the problems that we see in fraternities and sororities are the problems that we have in Smallwood, and they're the problems that's a downtown apartment building, or the problems we have in Briscoe. Mm-hmm. They might be exacerbated by the group culture and a group mindset, and they can be exacerbated by an environment of where loyalty to the organization may replace common sense in terms of holding each other accountable. So I think that explains the dynamic in which the problems occur. The advantages, the rosy-colored glass part of it is there is also, because there is that organizational structure, because there is that sense of loyalty, that plays out in the long run in many very positive ways.
Now, you have actually taken a much more direct hand in national fraternity affairs than I think a lot of our listeners are aware, not just in advising national fraternity organizations, but also having been the director since 1984 of the Interfraternity Institute, which is an annual workshop here in the summertime. Can you describe what the purpose of that is?
Sure. And by the way, both of these roles that I've played are sort of a result of Dick McKeag being at the right place at the right time. These are programs of Herman Wells and Bob Schaefer, in many respects. Bob Schaefer, Dean of Students at Indiana University. In 1971, Herman Wells, who was also president of his own fraternity, interacting with the executive director of that group, talked about some problems he foresaw in the relationships between fraternities and higher education, and talked about maybe we should create an institute that would each summer bring together people who work with fraternities and sororities, deans that work with fraternities and sororities, and executive directors of fraternities and sororities, convinced Bob Schaefer to take the lead. And from 71 on, that program existed. In 84, I had the opportunity to take over as as the director of the Institute. And the Center for the Study of the College Fraternity really is an effort. Herman Wells, Bob Schaefer, and Tom Schreck, who was then Dean of Students, were celebrating the bicentennial of the American fraternity, 1976. And out of the bicentennial came the thought there needed to be more scholarly work done on the role of fraternity in higher education, which led to the creation of the Center for the Study of the College Fraternity. Bob Schaefer was the first executive director of that. And again, I had the opportunity to take over that responsibility in the 80s. And so I was sort of at the right place at the right time in terms of developing that opportunity. And it was a good experience for me. I'd been a member of a fraternity as an undergrad and had actually held a national office. So several things came together to give me an opportunity.
I'd be remiss if I didn't comment on some of the many honors that you have accumulated over the years. To some of our listeners, they may have thought that you arrived full bore as dean of students, and it's always been that way. But interestingly, shortly after arriving here, I think shortly, within 10 years, student government had created a McKegg scholarship to recognize outstanding service to student government. In 2001, the School of Education gave you its Robert Schaefer, as previously mentioned, Distinguished Alumnus Award. In 2005, NASPA, the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, gave you its Scott Goodnight Award. In 2008, the campus gave you its Award Biddle Visionary Award for someone who had provided extraordinary service and vision to the campus. This is a place that seems to have taken a great liking to you.
I've been very, very blessed to have been at Indiana University and have had the opportunities I've had. And I tell people it's one of the rewards of getting old. they begin to look for who should get these awards, and your name keeps coming up. So,
well, that's a very nice thing to say, although they do seem to have started long before you got old.
Yeah.
In working in these fields, you have supervised student activities, student ethics, student advocates office, the program by which retired faculty and staff help individual students with their problems, student legal services, the health center, the sexual assault crisis service, veterans affairs, career development center, the alcohol and drug information center, really quite an array of student services. But all things that seem to intersect with moments of trouble or trauma in a student's life. And that is the sobering side of your job. How do you maintain your reputation for good humor and optimism and happiness in the face of some of these very sad individual cases?
Well, I suppose in some respects the humor is a defense mechanism. These are serious situations. We have had tragedies on this campus. Student deaths most particularly come to mind. And in those situations, there is so little you can do, and yet you try and do what you can to deal with those that are hurting and those that need assistance. And so, I mean, it goes with the job. You do it as best you can. I've said to some in some occasions, it's heartening, I think, the way I see the student community, the campus community draw together in those situations to also reach out and help. I have been to student funerals where families have filled the room with memorabilia from IU and spoke about how important their son or daughter's opportunity was to come to this institution. So in a sense, as I say, it reminds me of the important work we're involved in. It's not a part of the job that anyone, I think, ever enjoys or even can find ways to truly understand, but it's a part of the job that you do as best you can.
Knowing you all these years, I know how many times you have gotten in the car to drive to the hospital or to a meeting with parents of a student who has just died under a variety of circumstances. Those strike me as very hard trips and very long, although they may be short in minutes. What goes through your mind as you sit behind the wheel?
Again, as I say, it's you know, what can I do? How can I help? And the feeling of simply being so inadequate. But all of those experiences also have reinforced in me that sincere efforts tend to be appreciated and understood, and in some ways make the terrible, terrible situation just a little bit better.
That might be a good moment to pause for another selection you brought with us, sort of a melancholy and introspective song by Ray Charles.
I had the pleasure of seeing Ray Charles at the IU Auditorium. I frequent many of the shows over there. I've loved his music just forever. And this is a song written by Hoagy Carmichael, which again makes it kind of special because of that IU connection.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Dick, we were talking about some of the extracurricular activities you've been involved with, and I'm only going to pick a couple because there have been so many. For 10 years, you served on the board of directors of the local Convention and Visitors Bureau. Why that? What's
That's a good
the
question.
Dean of Students doing there?
That's a very good question. I'm trying to remember exactly. As I recall, I was asked to serve Doug Wilson, who had been a vice president of the university for many years, had been on the board, was leaving the board as he was leaving the institution. They were looking for someone who might step in. Somehow they decided maybe I could be of some service. We have done things with the board, Freshman Family Weekend, a few other kinds of promotions that had promoted tourism in the general sense of the word in Monroe County. And so I was invited to serve on the board. It was a real educational experience for me because it was, in a sense, I was a fish out of water as I started my service on the board because it was a kind of a different perspective than I was used to dealing with. I was very impressed with the work they did. And actually, one of the things that I kind of admired was the system of accountability they had in place to measure the impact of their services. And that's about the time higher education was beginning to get even more into the discussion of measurement and outcomes. And so it had kind of an interesting side benefit that maybe I hadn't anticipated.
One activity you've been involved in completely outside the institution and beyond the confines of Monroe County is your service on the board of directors of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Indianapolis. And I know that you served as a board member, eventually becoming president of the group. Catholic mm-hmm. Charities is one of the largest charitable organizations in the country. What emphases did you have during those years?
Yeah, I'd been locally involved in a parish and been president of a parish council in Bloomington when they were creating a charities board structure with lay involvement for the Archdiocese of Indianapolis, and was asked to serve on that. And at the time, because they were sort of creating this structure, a lot of my work kind of was helping and create the formation of the board, the articles, the bylaws, those sorts of mm-hmm. things. So they were early. It was clearly early years when I was involved in that activity. And Again, for me, a great learning opportunity to see all the good work that was being done across southern Indiana by various Catholic charity organizations. At the time, there was not even actually a Bloomington office of Catholic Charities. There is now. But there were major programs going on in some cities. Terre Haute was one that comes to mind in Indianapolis, certainly. And again, another interesting opportunity to meet with folks that I didn't normally interact with. All of those volunteer activities that I took on that were outside the campus bounds were sort of refreshing in that it introduced you to a new audience and a new set of concerns that kind of gives you that opportunity to set aside your normal routine and to experience and learn from new ways.
Now, all this activity, both job-related and extracurricular, is helped by a supportive family. And I know your wife is a retired high school Latin teacher, taught for almost 30 years. And Mary Beth has a great sense of humor, a wicked sense of humor. How has she played into your duties?
Well, I could not have done any of the kinds of things I've accomplished at Indiana University if it hadn't been for Mary Beth and sort of her support. We actually made a pretty good partnership in some respects. Being a high school teacher, she had to be at school at about 10 till 8, which meant leaving home sometime or shortly after 7 o'clock in the morning. I tended to have a college student lifestyle, which didn't do a lot in the morning, but had to be on campus late at night. So we had two children, and she was sort of the evening parent, and I was the morning parent. Much to the dismay of my wife and others, my sense of fashion, my colorblindness, my inability at setting hairstyles left my two daughters. It actually made them self-sufficient very early because they were horrified at what their father did to them in getting them ready for either daycare or school. So they learned to fend for themselves. But the job that I had at Indiana University and the way I kind of involved myself in the campus really made it necessary to have an understanding spouse and partner who would understand that you might not be home until, well, in fact, generally speaking, I was never home for supper until like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And for a period of time when the kids were really young, I would be home for supper but leave immediately thereafter. So it required a person with a sense of humor just to tolerate me.
All that activity and time away from home raises a story I once heard. I want you to tell me if this is true. IU administrators are expected to be reviewed by a faculty committee every 5 years. And obviously, you've been in office long enough to have been through several reviews. And I was told that as one of them started and asked for basic information, you went to your office to print out your entire schedule, your calendar for the year, showing literally hundreds of student events on your calendar that you had formally accepted and shown up at. And it was such a voluminous amount of paper that you looked at it and said, let's see what they do with this.
I can't remember if the story went just like that. But we had a regular practice in the office of printing out a monthly calendar of everything that had gone on. In those five-year review cycles, I was able to say, here's 5 years.
It's a tremendous workload. One thing that has struck me is students who don't know that we know each other have told me in breathless awe that the dean came to their event. And I knew from their description that their event was 40 people on a campus of 30 to 40,000, depending on the year. And there you were, and the stories were not atypical. You have often been seen at events of 40 students and 4,000 students. How important is it for the dean to show up?
Well, at least for the way I thought the dean's job might be done, it was very important. And because we're a large campus, you could be busy every night of the year and only be visible to a small portion of the student body unless you kind of selectively planned your schedule to go to different pockets of students, and that's sort of the way I tended to view the campus. And so while I might do an event with a Greek organization, I would want to also do an event with a residence hall organization, and it certainly would be important to be out at some of our diversity groups and their events, and then occasionally a departmental club would invite someone to come along or do something, or one of the sport groups would want something done. And you could go to just one of them and feel like you'd been busy, but that would still leave 99% of the campus that thought you didn't do anything but stay in your office. So it really became, over time for me, a way to be sure that I was out there being visible with groups of students. And sometimes, of course, the smaller groups allow the most interaction, mm-hmm. because you have a chance to talk to people as opposed to being introduced and stand up and most of the crowd don't even hardly see you in the other side of the room.
Clearly, you placed a high priority on visibility. Could you describe what your philosophy was or is now as you look at being a chief student affairs officer?
Well, I still go back to the fundamental mission of our division, which is to help students be successful in college, and that means enhancing retention. That means providing services that support their academic work. And so as the chief student affairs officer, my job was to make sure that the units in the division were providing efficient and effective services, and that I was sort of a role model for student engagement, and that I was out there making the campus approachable by students, that there was a face that they could turn to for assistance. And then generally speaking, of course, when they came to see me, I had to move them on to somebody that could help them, because I wouldn't have had the expertise that was needed. But at least they would know there was someone who cared, someone who was available, and someone who would do what he could to get their problem resolved.
What's the toughest issue you faced as a dean of students?
One of the things that maybe has allowed me to be dean for 18 years is to not spend a lot of time worrying about yesterday's decision. Mm-hmm. So in trying to sort out some of the toughest, it's a little difficult because I tend to focus so much on the now. I would say that the problems that I was least prepared for and least eager to do were the supervisory employee relation issues that inevitably you got caught up in. So I would say I was not necessarily a good supervisor, and supervisory problems, personnel problems, were probably the most difficult that I had to deal with during my term. The only other thing I would throw in there, of course, our earlier discussion about student deaths and student tragedies, those are difficult in a different way, and also were some of the more serious that I reflect back on.
You've served under a number of IU presidents, I think five, and over those administrations, the emphasis on and respect for student affairs has ebbed and flowed, some depending on the time, some depending on an individual. But I noticed that regardless of their feeling about student affairs, every single one of them had your phone almost on speed dial. If there was a student protest or a group of students standing at the Bryan Hall gates ready to be unruly, they sensed that the one thing that they had in their favor above all else was your relationship, your open communication with students of every stripe. That's not easy to maintain when you may be delivering bad news or standing between them and an administration that's not necessarily going to do what they want.
Correct. Part of the reality of the position. My earliest years in the field, 1967 was my first appointment at Stevens Point through 1971. Those were the years in which there was a great deal of student activism, even on a small state campus in Wisconsin, and we were only about an hour away from Madison, where there was considerable student activism going on. I guess early on I learned or developed skills in working with individuals in situations that are potentially divisive and disruptive and finding ways to try and be a calming voice and to facilitate communication. And possibly, if a wild day of great success, respect for each other, that's not always as easy to do, but at least communication and honest communication, and that's something that I've tried to do along the way. In most cases, I think the presidents I have worked for have not assumed that I controlled students or that I could be certain what students would do, and I'm sure the students I worked with knew I didn't control administrators. So in a sense, I was a go-between. I was a facilitator, but I was never held accountable by either of the sides for the actions of the other.
One thing I wanted to ask you before we finish is, drawing on your years of experience, if you were speaking to the several hundred administrators we have at IU or at any university, What advice would you give them for maintaining or developing their own good relationships with the students they serve, be they undergraduates or graduates, studious scholars or frivolous freeloaders?
I'm not so sure it's any different than the advice of anybody who kind of understands human relations. It's reach out in an open and honest and fair way, and get to know the student. Find out what their interests are, and I mean, where they're from, and what they do, and what their mom and dads do, and just get to know them as a person, and do what you can to help them within your scope of your responsibility. But just take them for who they are.
We've been speaking with Richard McKeag, who holds his doctorate in higher education and student affairs from Indiana University, retiring this year after a 38-year career in student affairs at IU and most recently as vice provost and dean of students. We'll close with a little music from one of your other musical genre interests, the Broadway musical.
Yes, this is from Wicked, a show I had the pleasure to see last fall and again most recently in Indianapolis. It's an interesting tune in that it the two female main leads are discussing their relationship with each other and how they've been changed for the better. And there's no question Indiana University changed me for the better.
I'm limited. Just look at me. I'm limited, and just look at you, you can do all I couldn't do, Linda. So now it's up to you, for both of us. Now it's up to you.
The program you have just heard was recorded in July of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.